Woods are 75 and 9, the awesome Wendy's in their prime, the bowl is quick, the batsman fine. Remember? Do you remember? Nope, I can't remember, that was too long ago. Yo. Holding Marshall, Garner, Lloyd, and Mighty Bibb.
Mighty Bibb.
They were going for the hat trick, the greatest team that lived. That lived. They swagger, then they stagger out. They shake their heads, they cry. How on earth did we lose to a team that played Yash Ball at 5?
If World Cup 2019 were an episode of Friends, would it be the one with the 3D glasses and the duct tapes? The one without the associates to steal a former colleague's tweet? Or just the one when cricket took us back on a joyride to 1992? I'm Srinath Sripat, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to Talking World Cup, where we get together with our top writers and experts and get chatting on all the big themes from the tournament or the best part of the next couple of months. To kick off our first episode, we've got a panel. Andrew Miller, our UK editor. Hello, Miller.
Hello there. How are we doing?
Osman Samiuddin, our senior editor, who's been with us on Talking T20 before. Hey, Osman.
Hi, Srinath. How are you doing?
Doing great. And one of our finest and funniest writers and our Sri Lanka correspondent, Andrew Fidel Fernando. How are you doing, Fidel? No pressure.
What up? Hey, how's it going? Yeah, you've basically set me up for failure in this podcast with that intro, but what are you going to do?
And together, the four of us have won as many World Cups as the favourites England have throughout their history. And so we feel perfectly qualified to chat on about the tournament. There's a million other people here tonight. You know, I could have a good one if I like. There's a million other people here tonight. That's no lie. I can't stay on standby. Miller, I'm going to ask you if you can identify these seemingly random series of lines to start off the episode.
Well, that's clearly Lauren featuring Rudimental's hit single that's just been released for the World Cup. I know
clearly. Well.
I am a music critic these days as well. So, and right at the cutting edge, clearly.
Miller's down for the kids.
There's your free plug, ICC. We've got you up and running right away. Right, we've got much to run through, including your questions from Twitter. So just to get cracking, I'm going to go around the room and ask all our panelists their earliest memories of the World Cup. Osman, let's start with you. How far back on the memory, the World Cup timeline, does your memory take you?
Have you gone with me because I'm the oldest?
I basically just
gone with you because I'm the old part in this, and I can remember back to maybe even the 1975 World Cup. No, I'm just kidding. I think the first one is the 87 World Cup. And the first thing I really remember was the great Courtney Walsh non-man-cutting of Salim Jaffer in the last over of a match. He gave him a warning, didn't run him out, and Abdul Qadir hit, I think, the next ball or the ball after that for 6. And Pakistan took 13 off that last over to beat the West Indies, who were still a good side then, you know. So that's probably my first clearest memory of a World Cup.
I was hoping you were going to say Imran lifting the World Cup and Inzi smashing.
I wish I was that young.
Right, Miller, the World Cup's back in England. I'm going to put to you a more specific question. What's the first memory of watching a World Cup game live at a ground in England?
Well, funny enough, it was India versus Pakistan in 1999. I was at university in Manchester, and the match took place up there at Old Trafford, like this one's going to, in fact. And it was a fascinating occasion. As usual with India-Pakistan games, it was a massive damp squib. Pakistan were rubbish. India won very easily.
It was a crap game.
It was really terrible. But obviously the backdrop was pretty lively. Cargill was kicking off, and it was all pretty. There was a bit of flag burning in the stands and what have you. But it certainly wasn't a riotous occasion. It was fascinating to be involved in a World Cup. It was. Obviously 20 years ago now, which makes me feel incredibly old as well. It was several years after my first World Cup memory, obviously, which was 1992 and Gucci's Glory Boys so nearly bringing it home.
The greatest England ODI side ever, by the way.
Of all time.
Ever. Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah,
even if they win this one, nothing will top that time.
Interesting, Miller, because you named the 1992 World Cup Final 11, and Owen Morgan's named his current 11 as his all-time World Cup 11 with Brian Lara and Adam Gilchrist.
Well, yes, we were asked to put our best 11s together for Crook Info, and I couldn't pick any team that, you know. Andrew Flintoff's record in World Cups was appalling. Kevin Peterson was appalling in World Cups. Darren Goff barely featured. I mean, England's record since 1992 has just been a disgrace at World Cups. So I had no option but to go with Richard Lingworth and and Dermot Freitas and Dermot Reed.
Dermot Reed, Chris Lewis.
Yeah, and Derek Pringle. I mean, Derek Pringle, who was one dodgy LBW away from being Sir Derek Pringle, the least likely World Cup legend of all time, surely.
James Faulkner.
Oh, yes, maybe.
It's the other one.
Miller, I'm not saying this because you said India-Pakistan, but my first World Cup match at a ground was England-South Africa in Chennai 2011. It was, I think, 172-170.
Oh, that was a low-scoring thriller, wasn't it? England kept that tournament interesting just by being rubbish at the right moments and losing to the wrong teams.
Being
as good or as bad as they needed to be to keep things interesting.
Was there a Stuart Broad forfer in there? There was something, wasn't there?
Yeah, it might have been, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Fidel, I'm going to come to you and ask you if you can give us the blockbuster answer from 1996 of Sanath and Kalu and Aravinda smashing it around. Is that your first World Cup memory? I'm really hoping it is.
Yeah, so absolutely. My first memory was the 96 World Cup. But my interesting that people bring up Richard Illingworth, because my memory of Illingworth was very different from Miller's first memory of Illingworth. I just remembered a lot of fours being hit in one over in Faisalabad by Sanath. I think it was four fours in a row. It might have been four or five fours in a row. That was a special World Cup memory. Also, an amazing one that actually me and another colleague at Crickinfo, or former colleague at Crickinfo, share. But we share like the mirror versions of this memory from the 96 World Cup. So I was just on my way home from school during that Kolkata semi-final where Sanath and Kalu get out in the first over. And I just remember turning the corner near my house, and there were a bunch of people watching the match at a corner shop near my house. I heard them sort of despair once, and then as I was climbing the steps into my house, I heard them moan again. I knew that two wickets had gone down. And in Kerala, George Binoy, who used to be our head the desk in our Bangalore office, he was coming home from school at the same time, pretty much the same thing, but he heard cheers in his apartment block and then another cheer, and he knew that two Sri Lankan wickets had fallen. So we had like mirror images of the same memory, which I think was quite cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to finish off, wrap up this section, I'm going to ask you, Fidel, where were you when the winning runs were hit at the Gaddafi Stadium in 1996? Do you remember the day? Did you expect Sri Lanka to beat Australia?
I think it was a surprise to everyone, and I think like everyone was just so excited that Sri Lanka had got to the quarterfinals, and everyone was like, this is great, this is the most amazing thing that's ever happened, and then they actually went on to win it. I think everyone was a bit stunned. I remember a lot of fireworks going on in our neighborhood. I was watching it in our living room with my family, I definitely remember what it was like, and I remember the next day at school what it was like, how no one learnt anything for like the next 2 or 3 days, because all anyone wanted to do, including the teachers, was just talk about how incredible this World Cup win was. And it was quite a special thing for the country. Like at the time, you know, it was going through quite a difficult period of the civil war. And to have something like that happen was quite, uplifting, and it distracted us all, you know, for a long enough period of time to make us feel good about ourselves. So, yeah, I definitely remember what all that was like.
Osman Miller, it's kind of perfect that you're in the same place. So I'm going to wind it back to 1992 and start with Osman. Imran's corner Tigers, where were you? Were you back in Karachi watching that? And did Pakistan kind of expect to beat England in the final?
No, I was actually in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia at the time, which is where I was growing up. And it was Ramzan. Which is like, you know, the great myth of all great Pakistan victories is that they take place in Ramzan. And I remember getting up stupidly early, of course, because it was MCG in Australia. And we went over to one friend's house where there were about 20 of us. Took the day off school. It was a Wednesday. I remember that. And we just watched. I think the more blusterful of us were pretty sure that Pakistan was going to win, but I've always been like a lifelong skeptic and pessimist. So I wasn't convinced until, I think it was until Wasim's two and two.
Snakes passed the batsman.
Well, I remember, like, you know, people forget, but Alan Lamb was a gun ODI batsman. He had pulled off miraculous chases before this. I think he took, what, 13 or 14 off Bruce Reid over to win it right at the end in a tri-series in Australia once. He was a proper ODI batsman, and Neil Fairbrother was very smart, and, you know, he could hang around in any partnership. So until Wasim did what he did, I at least was still fairly kind of, you know, they might not win this, they might not win this, which I think says something more about my condition than it does about any kind of cricket match situation or proper analysis. But yeah, it was an amazing day. You know, we took the day off school. We, after the game, it was still fairly early in the day, and we went out and we played a game all among ourselves. And it was, I just remember, it was one of those days where you always wonder how you're ever going to have a day like that again in life generally. And I don't think, despite a marriage and two kids and lots of other very happy life events, I've ever been able to relive that day.
I relive Miller, every single yeah. day.
Miller, that was before the It's Coming Home song came out, wasn't it? What was the feeling in England, and what did you all sing about the World Cup coming home back then?
Well, it was a bit of a weird one because it was obviously, being in Australia, it all happened overnight for us. I certainly recall being at home. I think it must have been Easter holidays, but it was on Sky, obviously, and I didn't have Sky in those days, so it was very much listening to it on the radio in the traditional sense, getting up fairly early, and then must be about early morning when the curtains were drawn around England's hopes and we were finally shot to bits. It was a great tournament though. I mean, the thing that struck me, I suppose, most was how unexpectedly great that team suddenly became. They never looked like being world beaters. I mean, you know, they, obviously Test cricket was probably a bigger deal for England back then, but, you know, Ian Botham was clearly has been when it came to Test cricket by that stage. He'd come back gloriously in the final match of the 91 series against West Indies and hit the final boundary to win the match. But you know, by all accounts, he was over the hill. But then roll up to a World Cup, particularly against Australia, he had the glorious last hurrah of taking four wickets and getting a 50 against Australia to basically dump them out of their own World Cup, which was just one of the great last send-offs that Beefy ever gave to the Aussies. And that
filthy four for
it was a disgusting four. I mean, he was England's leading wicket taker in the tournament, which I still find extraordinary because he was just bowling port medium paces, just living completely on the myth of Beefy and getting away with it until, of course, the final when he got that disputed caught behind in the first over and it was all downhill from then. But I recall to this day just how that team just came almost from nowhere. They somehow gelled. Again, going back to Botham, I mean, he was such has been by that stage. He'd actually spent the winter doing pantomime. I went to see him in Jack and the Beanstalk. He was the king in Jack and the Beanstalk alongside Bungle and Zippy from Rainbow. You ever saw that?
Of course.
Yeah, and various other, there was some Max Boyce, some Welsh impresario or something. It was a very weird scenario. So, you know, he was doing pantomime in Brighton Theatre over that winter. And then suddenly rocks up to nearly win a World Cup for England. That's just how Botham rolled.
Just the sort of intricate detail you'll only hear on an ESPN Trick Info podcast. Thanks, Miller, for that. Ian Botham as a pantomime star is something we've not heard about before. Now that we've got our fill of nostalgia, it's time to head into the preview proper of World Cup 2019. It is, of course, a very rare World Cup across sports with just a single group, which obviously has to double up as the group of death. And for what is the first time, a Test nation is missing out from the World Cup. Osman, I'll come to you first. It's also a listener question on the World Cup. If this World Cup turns out to be its best edition, will you support the ICC's decision of having 10 teams in the tournament, or would you still prefer a World Cup, in quotes, with more teams, even if it's just a compromise and sustained quality? That's from our regular feedbacker, Abhi Jato.
No, I mean, I love the format. You know, everyone plays everyone, and then the best teams get to the semifinals and the final. I love that format, but there's no way, I think, with a sane mind, that I can say that this is the best way to go ahead with the World Cup. I would rather have more teams in there, especially with the kind of results that teams like, you know, Afghanistan and Ireland are full members now, but the kind of results that other associate teams like Scotland and Holland have, and the Netherlands, sorry, have given us over the years, there's no way, I think, that you can call this a World Cup when there's so many teams out there who are not part of this tournament. I don't, you know, Zimbabwe, we forget Zimbabwe, you know, they've been to every World Cup since, I think, 80, well, tournament, I think they've been to every World Cup since 83, maybe, when they beat Australia in that tournament. Yeah, and I just feel like, you know, you have something like the Champions Trophy, which is your kind of short, sharp, you know, top eight teams in the world, and I'm fine with that as well. But you know, it's a World Cup, and you've got to have more teams in there. I don't think you go the way of FIFA and have 48 teams in there for sure. But you know, I mean, we've played World Cups now with I think 14 teams for a couple of editions, and I just didn't see anything wrong with that kind of approach. You've got to involve more countries in it. You've got to bring kind of different attitudes to the game, different flavors of the game from these different places. You can't just be a 10-team World Cup. It's almost like you're an American sport and you're pretending to be a world something when there's only 10 countries in the world in this tournament. How can it be a World Cup? You know, it's impossible. Forget the number of countries in the world. Just look at the number of member countries the ICC has. Even if you take out half of them for not being really serious kind of cricket nations, that leaves you with like 50-odd teams and you're playing a 10-team World Cup. It just, I think in no way does it make sense to me.
But then, you know, it's perfect. It's perfect fodder for one of your briefing columns. If you extend this all the way up to 2075, the World Cup might just be a tri-series.
Yeah, or just India playing. It might just be like the final of the Dalip Trophy or whatever. It could just be Indian states playing each other. What I was going to ask Miller was that, you know, it kind of strikes me as being a similar thing to the way the ECB headed, you know, 10, 15 years ago when they decided they were going to take cricket to just paid TV and take it off free-to-air TV. They went for the quick money or the short-term gain in terms of just having someone pay them a lot of money rather than go for a long-term development strategy, which has now resulted in them having to go to, you know, abominations such as the 100. As a way to bring cricket back to the masses in England, and I wonder if the ICC has gone down that same route. Does that sound like it's a parallel for you, or do you see any similarities there?
I'm calling it right away that it's going to go on all day, Miller. this podcast.
I'll try and keep this brief. I do see a parallel. I also think there is a subtle difference between what they've done with the ECB. But I mean that what they're doing with the 100 is a panic measure to try and claw back a lost generation. I don't think what's going on with this World Cup is quite the same scenario, because I honestly think that the way this format's structured, it's going to work. It's going to be a really good tournament. We're not going to have the scenario that we have had in previous World Cups where just because, I mean, I'm talking back to 2007 in particular, the biggest flaw in that World Cup was arguably also the greatest triumph of the World Cup, i.e. Ireland and Bangladesh qualifying and knocking out India and Pakistan. I can understand why the ICC are paranoid about a scenario whereby they lose the opportunity of having India and Pakistan playing each other, lose the marquee event. Never mind the money. The money is obviously important for making sure the big games and the big players play each other in these events. But it's also the spectacle. And, you know, when you had in 2007... Barbados, memorably, everyone had booked months, years in advance for the great India-Pakistan Super Sixes showdown in Barbados, and it turns out to be Ireland v Bangladesh. It wasn't a great World Cup, and it was let down by the one great moment, if you see what I mean. On the flip side, I do think that certainly the quality of the qualifying tournament and Scotland's victory over England last year and Ireland running them close recently, I think the gap between the best and the rest has narrowed considerably. I think it's narrowed far more than the ICC thought when they moved to 10 teams a few years ago. I think those associate nations have really come up quickly. Scotland, bitterly disappointed, and, a dodgy LBW again, was something that scuppered their chances of making it to this tournament. West Indies obviously didn't even win their qualifying events. Afghanistan went through, and I've been watching them in the warm-up today, watching the way their bowlers in particular have been going. They're going to take some scalps this tournament. I've got no doubt about it. And I've no doubt that certainly Scotland, probably Ireland, could have taken down a few teams as well if they'd been given the chance. So I've already banged on far longer than I want, but the point is, I think this tournament, leaving aside the politics, this 10-team tournament is going to be a great spectacle. The best four teams will get through to the top after a real bun fight, but it doesn't entirely excuse the fact that, yeah, it should have been expanded out to more.
You've nicely segued us into the next section, because this is basically the bit where we're all done moaning about the format, so we get cracking to the exciting bits. The first one we're going to do is get our hot takes out of the way. Miller, you've given an Afghanistan prediction, but we'll give you another shot. Fidel, let's start with you. What's your hot take? What's the most, like, what's the less expected or surprising or unpopular thing that you think will happen in the World Cup? No holds barred. Sri Lanka can lift the World Cup. That's also part of...
No, I would have to be a crazy man to say that. I'm not quite that crazy. So I'm not going to do that hot a take. But I think that England are probably the form team going into this World Cup, and I think everything points to them being champions. However, I just think that there is so much pressure on that team right now. In a home World Cup, with the kind of pressure that the media has, with the kind of expectation that is on them right now, I just don't see them winning a knockout game. That's my only hot take. I think they'll probably end the group stage right at the top. They might even beat India. I just think that there is just so much riding on it, on them, you know, from the corporate level down. I think it's no secret that the ECB have made this a priority, possibly at the expense of even the Ashes later in the summer. They've made this a priority over that, which is almost unheard of for English cricket. I don't see how they're going to mentally get themselves up for that knockout game. I think they're, once they get into those stages, which I'm sure they will, they're going to be a vulnerable team. That's my only prediction.
Osman, as one journalist yesterday at the captain's presser said, Safraz to lift the World Cup and become Prime Minister in 2039?
Unless he gets replaced by Joss Butler first, who he picked as the player he would most want, who would be the perfect replacement for him, in fact. So I'm not sure what he was doing picking Joss Butler as the one player he wants. Listen, I'm with Fernando 100% on this, that England have to win the World Cup. They absolutely will win the World Cup, which means, of course, that they will not win this World Cup. It will, you know, everything is just pointing in the right direction for them, and they will just lose it somewhere, whether that's an early game. But listen, they're opening against South Africa. That's no easy task. South Africa are going to be a tough team, you know, and it could be that it comes down to just one loss more than the other side who gets through. So I'm with Fernando on that. My other hot take, I guess it's an old hot take, and it's one that we trot out at pretty much every tournament, or somebody does, and it's that New Zealand will win the World Cup. And I'll just drop my bat like Grant Elliott there and walk off. But I think, I don't know, they've got a good side. They've always got a good side, but I think they've got a really good pace attack this time around. And I think the conditions, they've got a lot of bases covered. They've got some decent spin options now. They've got good, solid pace. Their batting lineup, you know, Ross Taylor, as we so memorably headlined, I think, is second only to Virat Kohli over the last, the last cycle since the World Cup, as an ODI batsman. And Kane Williamson, you know, if there's God, then Kane Williamson is right behind him. And then there's Virat Kohli and the rest, maybe. But, you know, Williamson is there. He's one of the best captains out there. In actual fact, you're looking at them, you think they'd be disappointed not to get right to the very end of this tournament, with the kind of side they have. My hot take would be that this time they might actually win it.
Miller, I'm completely with you on Afghanistan in that they're not just here to make up the numbers. That's actually one hot take in terms of how many games they'll win. I'm guessing they'll win at least two or three games in the tournament, which is no mean feat given the field. What's your actual hot take now that Afghanistan are out of the way?
Right, my actual hot take is England will win the World Cup. I've genuinely never been more confident about an England sporting team. I part of that confidence stems from the understanding of the tournament. As mentioned previously, the tournament is geared to ensure that the best teams can't screw it up early. So, as Osman says, they may well lose to South Africa in their opening game, but they're not going to lose four games out of nine. There's no way that's going to happen, which is basically what they need to do, I think, to rule themselves out of the reckoning for the top four. And once they're in the top four, all they're going to do is win two in a row, and they've won about 17 or 18 in a row on home soil in the last 2 years. So I don't think there's a genuine concern. I think they are as well prepared as I've ever seen a team. It reminds me, in terms of their preparation, they're as well prepared as England were in the Ashes going out in 2010-11. They've just left no bases covered, and most specifically, they are prepared with their backup. I mean, memorably in that Ashes tour, it wasn't so much the first 11 that won it. It was the backup guys. Tim Bresnan came into the team. You had Tremlett.
Chris Tremlett, yeah.
Chris Tremlett was this massive juggernaut coming in. It didn't play till the third test, and then was one of the stars of the series. And the same thing could happen with this team. You're going to have guys like Liam Plunkett potentially on the bench who won't be there. But, you know, if someone does go down or there's a little bit of an injury, in he comes. I mean, that's one aspect where the loss of Alex Hales is a blow, because Alex Hales was such a formidable guy to be able to bring into the side at last minute. But, you know, even James Vince, I was watching him smoking his first two balls through the covers of four the other day. He just gets it. He may only bat for 30 balls, but he'll get 40 runs in that time. He won't die wandering, which is exactly what this team wants from its batsmen. My other hot take is actually, I think bowlers are going to be more relevant to this tournament than everyone thinks. I don't necessarily think that means it's not going to be a massively high scoring tournament, but I also think that people by the end of the tournament will understand a little bit more that bowlers are still matter, even in a match where, you know, 350 plays 400, it's still going to be the bowlers ultimately that win the game. And I think people will have a better understanding of that by the end of the tournament than perhaps they do at the moment.
I hope we can I hope we can run that clip from the start of Miller talking about England winning this World Cup on July the 14th or 15th, whenever it is, just to remind him of how off he was with his hot take.
Absolutely.
I've nailed it.
We can blast it all over social.
It's what the social team is for. It'll be done.
I do feel sorry for Miller, because we've got a Sri Lankan and a Pakistani on this podcast, two famously unprepared teams that never rely on preparation. And England coming into this World Cup, as he says, is the most, you know, is one of the most prepared teams ever in the history of all World Cups. So this podcast is obviously geared to just laugh at the idea of preparation in general. And so I do sympathize with him in some ways.
We're just chilling.
I laugh at preparation in the real world, but where this team's concerned, it will work.
That's a load of nostalgia and some piping hot takes then. That'll do nicely for part one of Talking World Cup. Up ahead in part two, all the team previews and predictions. Now, Fidel, I'm going to come to you now that the hot takes are done with. I see every preview, every video starting with how England are the bookmakers' favourites and how, like Miller said, how prepared they are, etc. With you around, let's flip this around completely and ask you, help us and the world make a case for Sri Lanka being an exciting side to watch this World Cup for varying reasons, because they don't know how half the squad's going to play, including the captain himself.
Yeah, I think they've just, it's a hilarious sort of way that this Sri Lankan squad has come together, because they didn't know who their best players were. So they just picked a bunch of players who haven't played for a long time, just because they're like, at least these guys haven't failed in recent memory. So like guys like Jeevan Mendis, Dimoth Karanth, the captain himself, hadn't played a one day until just a couple of days ago against Scotland. For 4 years, he hadn't played. And then guys like Jeffrey van der Say, who's the leg spinner, hadn't played for a while as well. Lahiru Thiruman, another one who hadn't played for a while. So basically, Sri Lanka have had so many players come into the team and fail that they just ruled those players out, and they just brought in fresh batches of players who had failed a year and a half, 2 years ago. So it's hard to make a case for Sri Lanka, honestly, apart from to say that chaos sometimes spurs them to great things. I think some of their best performances, we saw in South Africa this year, they went and won 2-0 in a test series that they had no business winning, because The coach was on the rocks in with the board. He was sort of on the cusp of being fired. They had just changed captains. They had all these inexperienced players, and they still won in South Africa 2-0, which only two teams had before done. So that's the only hope that I think Sri Lanka have, that somehow out of this crazy chaos they'll pull something magical out. And Sri Lanka have done it at times in the past. There's also been plenty of times where chaos has been the death of them. Yeah, so there's been plenty of times when they've gone into a team, gone into a tournament with chaotic background stuff going on, and they haven't done that well. They've done as poorly as everyone expected them to. But they are kind of an unpredictable team. So and the format of this World Cup, you're guaranteed to play 9 matches, allows them to maybe, in a best case scenario, maybe lose the first 2 or 3, but then get it together and scrape their way into semis. And as Miller said earlier, from then on, it's just 2 matches away to a title. So that's probably the hope that the team is holding on to right now.
Brilliant. Chaos and the fact that it's an ICC tournament where Sri Lanka have known to raise their games in recent times, probably over the last decade and a half. They've been perennial semi-finalists. They've gone all the way in World T20s as well. So all of that, Usman, in comparison with Sri Lanka, Pakistan's problems seem to be a world apart. It seems to be like a fairly smooth, happy fairy tale at the moment in comparison with what Sri Lanka are going through.
Well, I mean, things off the field are going okay, but I would say they're probably not that much a better side at the moment than Sri Lanka. The ODI side, I think, is still very flattered by the 2017 Champions Trophy win, and I think that was more just a reminder that they can, they can still pull off those Pakistan moments over the course of a tournament. But they've got issues. I think they're not as bad as the 4-0 and the 5-0 score lines against Australia and England showed them to be. They're batting definitely. If you had said that they're going to score 343 games in a row against England in England, I would have said that's impossible. So they've done that. They're batting. I think the really good thing they've got going for them is that top three. Top three is a little bit one-paced, apart from Fakhar, who can go on. But like Imam and Babar and Haris Sohail, then they're all a little bit one-paced, which is a little bit of a problem. But there is stability there. The real
Asif Ali coming in has helped, isn't it?
Asif Ali coming in at number six, he changes the nature of that lineup, and he eases kind of Pakistan's fail-safe option, which is to always go for either one of Mohammad Hafiz or Shoaib Malik or both. And it is kind of time to move on, and Asif Ali gives them that option to be able to do so. I think the real problem, which has been happening since I think the start of 2018, is that their bowling, their one-day bowling, has really, really dipped. Guys like Hassan Ali, who has not been as awful as some of the others, but Hassan Ali has not had, he had a great 2017. He's not had the same kind of year last year since. He's been good. He's been okay, but he's not been like he was in 2017, which is also natural, I guess. That happens. Shaheen Shah Afridi, who had a really bright start, I think has found that against top teams like England in their backyard, and I'm just watching him play against Afghanistan now in the warm-up game, and he's struggling there a little bit as well. I think he's found that, the level just goes up a notch when you come against the very best sides in the world. He's still very, very young. He's still learning. Mohammad Hasnain, I don't know how many games he'll play. He's very raw. And of course, Mohammad Amir, who's kind of lack of wicket-taking form has been well-documented now. Although, so kind of wonky has the bowling been that to know that Mohammad Amir is back in the squad is actually some kind of relief for Pakistan, even though he's taken, less wickets than I have in the last 2 years. But it's actually relief that, okay, here's some guy with a little bit of experience, at least, who can do things. Shadab Khan will be back, and he'll make a difference to Pakistan's bowling for sure. But, it's the bowling that's the real concern right now, which is unusual for Pakistan. Predictions.
Usman. Even the bowling troubles is despite having three guys who can bowl 140 plus, which is again something that's really rare today.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I think some of it is just the natural cycle of a young fast bowler. They burst onto the scene, they have great seasons, and then they kind of get pulled back to what their natural level is, which is definitely what's happened with Hassan. I think it might happen with Shaheen as well, although he's not been around that long. Mohamed Hassanein is just too young. I don't know if they should have taken him to the World Cup. And, you know, they've panicked a little bit by calling back Wahab, you know, who last year, the way the management and Mickey Arthur were talking about him seemed like he would never play another game of cricket again. And now suddenly he's back because he can reverse swing the ball, which is, you're playing in a format with rules that specifically don't allow for reverse to really kind of blossom. How much of an impact he'll have, I don't know. But, you know, yeah, ultimately, like predicting what Pakistan will do,
it's a fool's job. It's not worth it.
If they win at the end of this, then wahe, we all knew they would or they could. If they don't, then well, we all knew they weren't a great side.
Your caveats aside, I was completely stunned and impressed by Mohamed Hassanein against England. He was basically running through the middle order that was smashing it around all parts of Trent Bridge. And if they don't pick a guy like that, are they even Pakistan? That's the question that I had in mind.
That's the question.
Yeah, Miller, before we get to England, I'm going to let you come off your long run up and bust the whole overhead English conditions myth. Is that even still a thing? We're seeing 300, 350, 400 being made all across the board, across grounds in England. Are there any World Cup grounds that are going to buck this trend at all?
Well, I was watching the Bristol match. Naby was getting the spin all over the place. So there will be one or two grounds where, there will be a bit of movement, especially if it's cloudy. There are grounds like Lords, particularly, look up, not down. But no, I mean, certainly when it comes to English conditions at the moment, I'm afraid the two white balls decision has really played into the hands of batsmen, because, you know, English pitches are kind of the best of both worlds for batsmen. They're not that, you know, the ball comes onto the bat in a way it doesn't in the subcontinent, but not so much as it does in, say, Australia. So, you know, it just comes off pinging over the stands. I mean, I'm obviously, as someone who's quite enjoyed watching England being good at one-day cricket, I'm not averse to watching loads and loads of runs being scored. And as I said earlier, I do think there's still a place for bowling, and people need to be careful to not get drawn into analysing bowling figures by the end result of two overs, no maidens, two for 71, say, and just think a little bit more carefully about when those two wickets were taken. I mean, it's a bit like what we got lined up with our smart stats on Cricket Info that we've been running through the IPL and we're running through the World Cup as well. It's, you know, analysing where these wickets happened. I mean, classic example was Mark Wood the other day. I mean, his figures didn't flatter him, but the way he came in and took vital wickets in the middle of the match against Pakistan, I forget which ground it was, but it was one of the ones where Pakistan put up a good fight. You know, that sort of extra pace, and Jofra Archer likewise is going to be able to do it, and, you know, all of the contenders for the latter stages of the World Cup, one thing they've got in common is they've got good bowlers. I mean, you can't write out Australia, who England obviously beat 5-0 last year, but, you know, they've got bowlers who will compete, and it will be the bowlers, I think, who are the vital part of any side winning this World Cup. And so, you know, you've got to separate the sight of sixes pinging out into the stands from the impact of wickets, because wickets will be important in this World Cup because they cause disruption. Mm. Even well set players need to take a little bit of time to get well set, and so, you know, breaking through at the right moment will be crucial.
The more you think about it intuitively, in a tournament where batsmen are dominating conditions and they've got suitable conditions to dominate across grounds, the bowler's importance will obviously go up because only the best can thrive. Osman, in your pre-tournament piece, which is scheduled to go up in a couple of days, you remarked that you're looking forward the most to watching the wrist spinners. And if you go through all lineups, like Miller said, you've got so many good spinners for a tournament in England, which is both a sign of the times and the fact that the expectation is that spin will play a big role.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, there is kind of a theory going around in limited overs cricket that, you know, balls turning away from the bat are what's kind of bringing success, whether that's success in reducing the number of runs or getting wickets. Those are the important ones. Although there were brief trends in this IPL, I think, where even the finger spinner was kind of back in action. But I think, you know, you need something different And the leg spinners still, I think, you know, because they're not as prevalent, they are more prevalent than ever before, but they're still not as prevalent as I would guess your average off spinner. You need that kind of change in your attack. You know, and it's been throughout. Shadab has played a massive role for Pakistan. Rashid Khan, of course, for Afghanistan. Even guys like Adam Zampa, Adil Rashid for England. You know, he
Imran Tahir as well.
For him. We were looking up some figures for Adil Rashid the other day, and I think he's the highest wicket taker in ODI cricket since 2015. And, you know, England's bowling, you would say, is not their strength, yet they have proved that it's actually strong enough. I mean, what England need to do is basically score 450 and prevent the other side from scoring 451. And I think their bowling attack is good enough to do that. Adil Rashid's economy rate is among the highest, but he picks up wickets, which, as Miller was saying earlier...
He's become a sort of specialist of expensive fifers. I think 5 for 84 he took and he won them the game in the West Indies.
Exactly. And, you know, that's actually kind of an evolution of what Imran did in 92, where, you know, his theory all along was that you play leg spinners in one-day cricket because they attack, they get hit as well, they're expensive, but they pick you wickets. Now, you know, that's taken on to a slightly different dimension in today's cricket, but essentially the thinking is the same. That a leg spinner, he might give away runs, but he will get you wickets as well. I think, you know, that's one of the things. The other slightly tangential point I wanted to raise again, and this is going back to England, is that, you know, I don't think they often get enough credit for what a freak once-in-a-generation batting lineup this is. You know, it's all good talking about the pitches and the two balls at each end and the big bats and stuff, but you know, no side in the world is just producing the kind of displays with the bat that they are. And to have guys like Bairstow and Roy, and Hales is not even in the lineup anymore.
Lunkett at 10.
It's crazy. Stokes coming there, Moeen Ali coming there, Owen Morgan, who used to be the odd man out, is now actually the odd man out because he's almost like the most normal batsman alongside Joe Root.
So true.
It's an insane, insane batting lineup, which doesn't get enough credit for actually the skills and the technique they possess.
And the dominance of spin in the middle overs. I think like we ran numbers end of last year about how much each of the England batsmen have improved against spin. Yeah. And some batsmen who weren't that good became very, very good batsmen. And others like Joe Root and Owen Morgan, who were already outstanding batsmen against spin, became absolute monsters against. It's almost got to a point where other teams have to look at it and be like, do we bowl spin against England during the middle overs? Because that is where I think this England batting order separates itself, is where other teams tend to sort of just build up through the middle overs, to the death overs. England are going, you know, nuts completely through the innings. So there's just no let up with this England batting order. There's no period in the middle overs where you can expect a little bit of relent from them. They're just absolutely all over you all the time. That's been the most impressive thing to watch.
Further to that point as well, I make a point about England's bowling as well, because again, you know, there's a lot of criticism for the fact they are expensive. But, you know, talking about specifically those middle overs, the fact is that England have options in their bowling that allow them to change tack. You know, they don't have to go to a set formula. I was reading Munger's preview of India, who he keeps calling favourites, which is factual inaccuracy because they are not the favourites. But he keeps talking about them saying, oh, they'll be fine as long as their fifth bowler muddle through. Right? That's not really an option. You can't just muddle through and expect to win a World Cup. England have got a position whereby a bowler as good as Ben Stokes might not actually bowl much at all in this World Cup. Mm. If Ben Stokes doesn't bowl, England have probably won the game. It's that good because they have options so many. And they've got two spinners. They've got Jofra Archer coming in now, who may be a guy who can bowl in the middle overs. He may be a guy who bowls at death. He may bowl the new ball. But Owen Morgan will be able to juggle his resources and tailor the way England play their attack to suit the batsmen in their sights. And that's an advantage, I think, that England genuinely take into this tournament. It's not as simple as just looking at the number of runs that people can take off them. It's when they score those runs.
Can I just throw in here that Liam Plunkett has a lower strike rate than Waqar Yunus in ODI cricket? That's my two bits for this one.
That's your hottest take of the day, Usman. And all of
I
this
think it is the hottest take of the day.
Yeah, and this is without even starting to talk about Joss Butler, the ultimate freak show that he is, because he kind of owned the entire England-Pakistan series, and before that in the West Indies, and before that in Sri Lanka. Yeah, he's been in such a hot streak of form for about 6-8 months, or as long as we can remember. Miller, is he widely touted or widely picked as the player of the tournament should England go all the way, because he seems to make the difference every single time whenever he comes into bat?
Yeah, I think one thing about World Cups is they do confer greatness on batsmen. And George Lebel made this point in a piece he wrote the other day, that Butler is in the mood to be literally on the cusp of greatness. If he can have the tournament that he should be able to have, given the form he's in, and England win, which, as explained, they should be able to do because of the way the format's structured, you know, he has a chance to go down in legend in the way that, you know, Viv Richards did in 79 or Gilchrist in 2007. You know, it is beckoning, frankly. It is 11 games potentially in this tournament. He could have a phenomenal time. He could, of course, fall in a heap. But if he does, I still back England to have enough guys around him to cover him off. I mean, you know, he got a duck in one of the games the other day. I think both he and Moeen Ali got ducks in one match, but England still found runs further down the order because they have this extraordinary depth, as mentioned.
Didn't they chase 360 without him?
Yes, they did. Yeah, which is just mental. So, but yeah, I mean, he is something else. Some of his innings in recent times have just been bewilderingly good. That innings in Grenada for one. Obviously, Chris Gayle stole lots of the limelight afterwards, but England did score 400 plus and hold out to win the game. It's been remarkable to watch him come on through.
Miller is just throwing the most massive jinxes.
Oh God!
Butler's gonna have a run of like 6 games for duck. Not a single double digit score.
And I haven't even mentioned Morgan's finger injury scare yet. But never mind.
It's all falling apart.
Yeah. And A.B. de Villiers in 2007-esque four ducks sort of tournament for Joss Butler coming up is what Usman's predicting. But by the way, this is a World Cup preview podcast. We're about 25, 27 minutes into it, and we've not said a single word about South Africa, which says a lot about where we are going into this tournament. Start with any of you whoever wants to talk about it. For the first time ever, nobody's reverse jinxing or jinxing them ahead of the tournament, and they seem to be an actual dark horse going into a World Cup for once. Miller, we can start with you.
Yeah, they do, don't they? There's no one's really bat an eyelid. Faf was asked a question about it at the captain's press conference yesterday. I think Telf Advice sort of euphemistically says your World Cup history has been interesting. That's putting it mildly.
In a Chinese way.
The trouble is
you've never had an uneventful World Cup. That was also said.
I mean, the trouble with South Africa though is no matter how many times they try to sort of change the narrative and sneak in the side door, still, when push comes to shove, it is South Africa in a World Cup, and every single time there will be that unquantifiable pressure that will crop up. People will start saying the word as usual. It happens every time, and you know they have got such a cruel history in the tournament that sometimes you wonder, is it an inescapably cruel history? A bit like England, maybe. So perhaps the same goes for England as well. But again, as mentioned, home soil and format. I think England can buck that trend. I just don't think South Africa are quite good enough to buck that trend this year.
How can they outdo their predecessors when it comes to a tournament in England and outdo the Donald Klusener-level expectations on them in a semi-final? We don't know. Fidel, let's just, talking of South Africa, what's going to be the Grant Elliott bat drop moment of the year, and how do you rate New Zealand's chances this time?
Yeah, I mean, just on South Africa, I was there early in the year for the Test series, and the amount of talk about the World Cup already, it's not just something that sort of weighs on the team consciousness. It's something that, you know, no one in Sri Lanka at the time was focused on, while the tests were going on, was focused on the World Cup. The World Cup is just something that rolls around and you start playing it. And I was just, kind of amazed at how many people in South Africa were talking about the World Cup and South Africa's chances and getting into the nitty-gritty of who's going to be picked, and long before many other teams probably got to that stage. And it is quite like a big psychological weight now. I mean, they've
they've done it in so many different tournaments. I was there in Sydney last time when they won their only knockout game in all of World Cup history. And then the following match, when they were running into each other, a match that was there to be taken, running into each other, dropping catches, missing runouts, and bowling length on one of the smallest grounds in the world. Like, that all adds up. And so I'm going to be watching South Africa very intently. I mean, it's going to be one of the most interesting journeys in the World Cup. I hope there's a little bit of redemption for them somewhere, because I think it's got to the point where I think it's stopped being like hilarious and started becoming like a little bit like we feel sorry for you kind of thing.
still hilarious.
For once, Fidel, South Africa have got a World Cup winning captain in their squad in Aidan Markram, who's already lifted the under-19 trophy.
Yeah, of course. So maybe he's going to be the one who changes things. I think, though, if it comes down to it, I think if it's Rabada bowling the last over and he's got, like, you know, 7-8 runs to defend and it's a knockout match, I would back Rabada in that instance. We saw him doing at the IPL for Delhi.
Against Russell. Super over. Yeah.
That's right, yeah. In a very, very high, the worst batsman that you could possibly have at the other end in that situation. And if it's, I think there are a few players, like, I think Quinton de Kock is another one who I think would win through in a tough mental situation. Him and Rabada are people that I would probably put my trust in if it came to one of those high pressure situations. The others I'm not so sure about. Imran Tahir probably a lot of people would back, but I think in a high pressure situation he's susceptible as well. But Rabada and de Kock give them a bit of hope. Maybe Markram as well. We'll see. In terms of New Zealand, I think they just have, they always raise their games for big events. And I think that their bowling is very good. I think Bolt is going to have a great World Cup. And as Osman mentioned earlier, their middle order is very good. There's a bit of injury concern over Latham, if I'm not mistaken, but, who's a very key member of that middle order, but, with Williamson and Taylor there, they're very well set up. Also, always the best fielding side at World Cups. I think if you go back through World Cup history, I know we say like Australia, South Africa are always very good at fielding when it comes to World Cup, but New Zealand seem to just have that extra bit of zip around them on the field. I'm very much looking forward to watching them at this World Cup as well. Henry Nicholls has been another great find for them. Interesting to see how Jimmy Neesham gets on. I'm not so sure about the Tom Blundell selection, but I think that he's just a backup wicketkeeper, so maybe he's not going to play much of a role, but they're going to be a fantastic team to watch as well. I the one thing I would say is that their opening partnership is a little bit shaky. Martin Guptill's great in some instances, but I think when he comes up against like really high quality bowling attacks, he can get a little bit exposed, and Colin Munro probably hasn't got the kind of isn't as reliable as many other openers
in
the tournament. So yes, exactly. So in big games, maybe that top order, that very top order before it gets to Williamson and Taylor is a little bit vulnerable, and maybe that's where their weakness is.
Right. England, South Africa are done. We move on to a couple of other big elephants in the room, probably what we can call the chasing pack here, with England being the anointed favourites for the tournament. India and Australia, let's start with India, Osman. Specifically in terms of how balanced they've been and how successful they've been, except for a couple of these loopholes in terms of their number four spot, etc. In a long tournament like this with 9 league games, you expect those sorts of issues to sort themselves out over time, don't you?
Yeah, I guess you do. Although I sometimes feel with India, like, do they really? They're like really looking for a problem to create. The number four spot. It's not like it's not really held them back or stopped them from winning and doing really well over the last few years. Yeah, it's an issue, but you know they've not needed the
number four batsman.
Well, they've got one of the finest opening partnerships going around in one-day cricket. They've got a guy in that opening partnership who lives for big tournaments, Shikhar Dhawan, you know, whose record at massive events is huge. They've got Rohit Sharma, who's, you know, but for Virat Kohli in that side, Rohit Sharma would be the guy who kind of bosses that batting lineup completely. And then they've got Kohli himself, you know. So, I mean, yeah, and they've got, okay, I should throw this out there with a drum roll, and they've got Dhoni as well, you know. But, you know, it's not like the number four. I've never felt like the number four is a massive, massive issue for them. The thing that really gets me about India, the really exciting thing, you know, because we've seen their batting come good for forever now. But the thing that really I'm excited about is their bowling. And Jasprit Bumrah, man, he is, I mean, you know, he's the kind of guy that, you know, Pakistani pace aficionados just will love. He's unorthodox in the way he runs in. He's got this hyperextension in his arm, which, of course, all the Pakistanis think means he's chucking, but, you know, he's not. And he's just got this kind of high school temperament. And he's phenomenal to watch. As a bowler, he's so, so good to watch. So I think, you know, India, if they don't get to the last four, that would be like a massive upset, I think, for them. You know, and I think they're going to coast. I say this now as famous last words, perhaps, but I think they're going to coast into the last four. And then once you're there, that is just how you turn up on the day. But I think
the one selection mistake away on semi-final day from crashing out of the tournament is what some of us here feel about them.
Yeah, I mean, you can say that about any team, really. You can say that pretty much about anything, but I just feel like their bowling is stronger than it has been for a while. It's just better rounded than it has been. I mean, you know, guys like Kuldeep Yadav, just coming along. I feel like India and they're like probably the best fielding side from India that has ever existed. You know, over the last however many, the best ever, really. So I just feel like it's almost inevitable that they'll get to the semis. And for them, I think the semis is kind of where the tournament starts. And I'm not trying to reverse jinx or something. I'm not doing any of that here. I truly believe that it should be inevitable that they get to the semis because they're just a gun enough side in big tournaments and they've just got good enough players to get there. And the tournament really begins for them, which is a shame because, you know, then you're talking about only two games that you're judged on. But that is essentially what they will be judged on, is how they do in the semis and then if they get there, the final.
You've given us the podcast headline, Pakistani Journalist Reverse Jinxes India Crashing Out of World Cup 2019. Miller, did you ever think there would come a day when Australia would be underdogs and England's favourites going into a World Cup, which has sort of happened now?
Nope. Never. But, I mean, Australia, God. I mean, Australia are just lurking, aren't they? They're you know, last year, they honestly looked like the final head of the Hydra had finally been chopped off. It's like, batter them 5-0 on home soil, batter them 4-1 in Australia. It was like, you know, then obviously the ball tampering and everything came with it. But, you know, I go back to the point I've been making on the bowlers. Their bowlers are good enough to cause any team bother. In English conditions, Australian quick bowlers love bowling in England, and they will be very good at that. I think, you know, with Warner, you know, he proved the extraordinary return to form. He produced for Sunrisers in the IPL when he came back from his ban. He's got a point to prove. Steve Smith's got a point to prove. I mean, Smith's an interesting one, actually, because around the time of the ban, he was actually looking a bit ropey in one-day cricket. Admittedly, his form in the England series came off the back of his Bradman-esque form in the Ashes. He was entitled to be a little bit blown out. But I think he averaged 20 with a strike rate of 60. And it's just, that's not good enough for modern one-day cricket. So I'll be interested to see what he's really like back at the sort of the form and focus that he can bring to one-day cricket. And Glenn Maxwell, you know, for some reason, the management don't trust him. But he's the type of guy who can turn a game on its head, given half a chance. So they're always dangerous. But no, they are underdogs, and it's a fascinating position for them to be in. I mean, you know, I don't think either England or India, assuming as I do, as Osman does, that they will be in the semis. Neither of them will want to draw Australia in that semi-final.
Yeah, Australia, of course, were desperately unlucky in the Champions Trophy 2 years ago. And it sounds all kinds of odd saying Australia are rank underdogs going into a World Cup. Before we wrap up with the last couple of teams, Fidel, just coming to you on Afghanistan and specifically their spin attack and Rashid Khan. We're speaking about 300, 350. Osman made the point that the bowling attacks are going to bring down average scores here and there when you talked about India. Do you give Afghanistan any chance beyond the odd upset in this tournament? Because they're definitely not here to make up the numbers, and their batting has improved leaps and bounds over the last couple of years.
No, I think they... Look, I think there are teams during this World Cup that they can target. There are teams that, have a weakness against the kind of bowling that I offer, spin bowling. But then there's also teams that that are quite tightly wound when it comes to major tournaments. And Afghanistan are a team that have pretty much nothing to lose. No one expects them to win, or very few people expect them to win the World Cup. And I see a little bit of like 1996 Sri Lanka about them in terms of like having some very key players who are hitting form, who are like some of the best in the world at the moment, and them being able to carry the rest of the team. And as long as there's a little bit of sort of fire that gets lit under the entire team, and even like the supporting players who aren't necessarily the stars begin to contribute, they can launch a very, very good World Cup campaign. If I had to pick like a complete dark horse to get into the semifinals, I would definitely say we've talked about India and England definitely being there. If I had to pick a dark horse to, and New Zealand having a very good chance, I would pick Afghanistan as a dark horse fourth semifinalist, honestly, because I think there's just something about the way they've approached they're getting into here and the lack of pressure on them that I think will be very freeing for them as a team.
England, India, Australia and Afghanistan, Fidel's final four if you had to pick a dark horse.
India, England, New Zealand and Afghanistan.
New Zealand, Afghanistan, sorry.
I would go India, England. I think West Indies, a very, very good chance. They'd be my dark horses. I think just the pain drain that they can bring to the game, just the ability to hit sixes at will. You know, they don't run singles, but they can make up lost ground in a chase in the blink of an eye with, you know, Gale at the top of the order, Russell in the middle, Hetmyer, who could be one of the real breakout stars of this tournament. They are a very good shout, and a bit like Afghanistan, they've had to do the hard work to get here, going to the qualifying tournament as well. So they've got an awful lot of incentive, I think. Wounded their pride to even have to qualify for this tournament, and Jason Holder is obviously a quality leader of men, and he's galvanised the side, and they've got better political situation behind them with a new board. They've got everything's falling into place for them in a way that perhaps hasn't in recent years. So I would very much like to see them rewarded for their improvements and get into that last four. And beyond that, it's hard to rule out Australia just lurking their way in there. I think they'll find a way. I think Warner in particular is a guy who looks on a mission to complete what he spent a year ruminating over. So, there we go. England, India, Australia, West Indies for me.
So, everyone thinks India and England, and I do really think India and England were there. But if you're putting me on the spot, then I've got to say one of them will not make it to the semis, which will make it a really fun World Cup if that happens. So, I would say, just because it's a home tournament, and we know England's history in all sports for home tournaments, England out before the semis, so let's go with India. New Zealand, I think, will be in there. I have a feeling South Africa, because nobody's really watching them that hard, might sneak in. And then, of course, it's an open round, everyone plays everyone tournament. Pakistan are looking so bad that they've got to make it to at least the semis. So I guess I go with India, Pakistan, South Africa, and New Zealand. There you go. Just to make sure.
So basically,
you haven't
mentioned Sri Lanka, which is about right.
Yeah.
And Bangladesh. Don't forget Bangladesh.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, the two nations under the radar with all three of your predictions. And just so that I can add my own clip to Osman's at the end of the tournament. Yeah, I'm going to say India, England, Australia and Pakistan so that Osman and I can be the Nostradamus at the end of the tournament in terms of who gets through the semifinals. Excellent. Just before we wrap up then, we had a bunch of questions from you listeners. So before this podcast, we put out a tweet and you had responded with some fine questions. The first one has to be the one to Fidel from Ranjit, who asks, no Dickwella, no World Cup, why would you leave an exciting player like him out of your 15?
Look, I wouldn't have left him out. I think it's a selection mistake to leave him out. He's also run out of form, like, quite drastically over the last couple of months. But I don't think in a World Cup where your team's guaranteed to play 9 matches, and you're picking the team like a month and a half out from the World Cup, you pick on form, you pick on quality, because you sort of back your best players to come good during a long campaign. So I think for that reason, basically, Dikwela was dropped on form. Also, there was one match in South Africa where he had to hit the stumps from, like, 2 meters away while the batsmen were running a bye. And if he hit the stumps, Sri Lanka would have won that game. Instead, they went into a super over. So I think that counted against him. That just came at just the wrong time. And then there was a domestic tournament in Sri Lanka where he did quite poorly as well. So all of those things added up against him. I don't think it was particularly fair. But I don't think it's an absolute howler, but it's not a great selection call. That's essentially it. That's Dikwela's. I think a lot of people were looking forward to watching Dikwela Dick Scoop the first ball of the World Cup over his head, but that's not going to happen anymore.
Miller, Akhil asks you, with regular scores in 350 range, is something we've spoken about. Is this going to be the dullest World Cup ever? Because there's absolutely no competition between bat and ball.
No. As I've been saying all along, the bowlers are going to be vital in this tournament. You're just going to have to get used to the idea that bowlers can be expensive and still be vitally important to a team's cause. You know, it's a bit like we've seen in 2020 cricket in the last few years. It's bowlers that win you matches. Bowlers are the ones that go for the big bucks when it comes to the auctions. Anyone in the world can hit a six in this day and age. It's a few bowlers in the world who can bowl the ball that can't be hit for six that are the most valuable. And that, I think, is the calibration we're going to have to put on this World Cup. I don't know how you can be bored by watching 700 runs in a match. I don't get that.
If you paid for tickets, that much
people
more.
People say it's turning into baseball. Well, it's not turning into baseball, because in baseball you hit about 2 home runs in a game. I mean, how it's a completely daft analogy to make. It's far more interesting than baseball. How can you not be entertained by watching the ball sailing out of the ground in all different directions as much as possible? It's fun.
Yeah, you're spot on. I've been watching cricket for the best part of 2 decades. I've never heard so many oohs and ahs from the crowd during an ODI game in England as I have heard in the last couple of years. You're absolutely spot on. And it's that much more enjoyable if you're on the ground, and just as much if you're watching on TV. This had to be the final question to Usman. Aditya asks, will Wahab send a couple of scorching overs against Australia again, do nothing else, and then get auto-selected for the 2023 World Cup?
Yes. In which he will be captain.
Brilliant. That's a short and sharp answer from Usman to wrap up the first episode of Talking World Cup. We are just a few days away from the tournament. Remember to catch all the action on ESPN Cricket Info. If you're in the UK, Australia, New Zealand, you'll be able to watch highlights. And the rest of the world, we've got all the usual fare, starting with our ball by ball and the usual coverage from our writers around the grounds. Thank you, Usman, Miller and Fidel, for joining us in this episode. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been great.
Lovely. Cheers. And thanks to you, listener, as ever, for listening to the podcast. I hope you had as much fun as we did recording this. And remember, you can subscribe to us on iTunes. Remember to leave us a rating, because it helps more and more people find the podcast. And of course, you can get it on all the other usual podcasting platforms, from Stitcher, Pocket Cast, Audio Boom, or anywhere else you get your podcast from. That's all we have from ESPN Cricket Info Talking World Cup, before the World Cup. Cheers.